I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, Portland's community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromise news media. Today, Bill Resnick interviews Teresa Rayford, a leader in Don't Shoot Oregon and other social justice organizations, putting the pressure on for what the established media calls criminal justice reform, which in fact must be a complete transformation of the police, the sentencing system that puts enormous numbers of people away for a very long time, the treatment of prisoners, the responsibilities of judges and prosecuting attorneys, among many other things. I'm sharing a reading entitled The Sick Ocean by Robert Hunzigara. Several decades ago, one of the founding members of the Old Mole Variety Hour, Joan Bohorfish, produced a radio documentary, along with Dina Dickerson, on the multiple meanings of the headscarf in Islam. It is timely today as it was then, and we will conclude our program today with that radio documentary called Scars of Many Colors. But now here's Bill and Teresa.
Teresa Rayford, welcome to KBOO again.
Well, good morning, Bill. Thank you.
Teresa Rayford is a great activist in Portland with Don't Shoot Oregon. Is it Don't Shoot Oregon or Don't Shoot Portland?
Don't Shoot Portland, but
don't
you're giving me ideas.
Don't Shoot Portland, but it's for all of Oregon and, in fact, the country. They're active in, quote, criminal justice reform. It's a rotten system, and all of it has to be really radically changed. Don't Shoot Portland and many affiliated groups have, and Don't Shoot United States and Black Lives Matter and many affiliated groups have created a movement for black lives. It issued a wonderful statement of the kinds of demands that are necessary to not just enable blacks to and people of color to come out from what is really an oppressive state for most people, but also white people. It's a change in the economic and social system that they're demanding. I think it's going to get a lot of traction in the next couple of years. We'll be talking about that. That is the larger demands for jobs and housing and many other changes, protection of poor, vulnerable workers. It's quite a substantial and wonderful document that people might look for. First, Teresa, let's talk about what happened last week. There were two shootings of unarmed black men, other shootings as well. The ones in Charlotte and Tulsa have gotten the most media play. On very short notice, that is a couple days, Don't Shoot Portland scheduled a march. Tell us why it's so important to keep marching.
Well, basically, Bill, when we do our protest, it's a call to action. It's in solidarity with the families and the community members that are fighting the police brutality and the circumstances in which they're thrown into because of the state war against black people. And so when we did the protest, and I know that you're like, oh, it's very short notice. Well, we wanted to wait until there was a need for a demand. And the need for the demand came when the community there in Charlotte was basically asking for the videos. They were asking to have the video released to the public, and we knew that the video was going to be released of Keith Scott being murdered to his family, but they were also saying that the community needed to see it. And not only were we protesting in solidarity to uplift his name and bring the humanity to the person that was murdered by police, but also to show solidarity and to demand that those videos be released and to also bring awareness back into our own city about the police violence and the white supremacy and the systems that bind us. And especially at a time like now, where we have a collective bargaining agreement on the table dealing directly with police brutality. And so timing is everything.
You have to keep the pressure on or the killing, it just becomes another daily fact, as it was like 20 years ago when there was even more police killing.
Yeah.
But there weren't video cameras that began showing it, everybody with a camera. A lot of the evidence was only the police testimony. Now, when that video's begun to be shown, I think that was an important part of it.
Or like the Rodney King beating.
For most, even white liberals, they had no idea of how horrible in these imprisoned areas, white and black, where police had complete impunity.
Yep.
Basically, poorly paid people everywhere, with a huge predominance, of course, of black people who were segregated into their own little prison gulags.
Well, as you notice with the protests, we promote the filming of police. At the protests on Friday, we had to continuously say, film the police, because we didn't understand why riot cops and SWAT gear and with guns and all types of military equipment were showing up to a protest where they knew it was going to be predominantly families and children and people with disabilities. I mean, again, our police state and whatever system of control is basically using the physical force of police officers to create a fear for community members, but at the same time saying it's important for us to engage with them. It's chaotic to me.
Yeah, I saw a lot of video of the Charlotte marches on establishment media, and their primary story was, oh, this march is without violence. And then, of course, there's these robocops showing up all over.
With the violence.
And with the violence. But even if there's no violence at all, even if not one garbage can is put on fire, and you can be sure when a garbage can gets on fire, it gets on the news. Well, there was violence at this one. That their whole rhetoric is it violent or not? Which, of course, is a statement is these black people are violent people.
And it's sickening because they're saying that when we hurt an object or when someone injures an object, that's more violent than the death of our children, and they know that's what we're out there fighting for. Mayor Hills brought that up the other day in City Hall, and I thought it was a disgusting time to bring in that type of rhetoric. We had children, we had families, we had people that had never been to City Hall before that walked several hours from Northeast Portland to bring their grievance to their mayor. And we got there, and he tried to chastise those community members and whoever followed us in there as allies and accomplices and whatever we needed to make it happen. He chastised them about graffiti, and he knew that they were in there because of the blood of dead children. He knew that we were in there speaking the name of Keith Scott and Terrence Crothers. He knew that. You know, he knew that we've been talking about Keaton Otis and Kendra James and Aaron Campbell and all of the people that were killed here in our own community. But he decided to bring up vandalism. And that's one of the things that we have to break. The state is being appropriate in their response to black people because they're protecting things and property. And it's violent for us to be in those spaces. They don't want us in those spaces. You know, it's sickening, but we have to change those things. Those are all policy things.
That's part of it. We talked earlier again about the current climate and the way that black bodies now inspire fear, and it's happening. And the fear is being promoted in the most obvious ways by people like Trump. But the fear is promoted everywhere, so we can have Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, as being the most beloved athletes of the century. White kids, white men, white racists.
Love them.
Love them.
They're games, they're toys, they're objects. They're not people to them, because as soon as they get on their knee or they demand that they don't stand for the anthem, then of course they want to lynch them. Trump is American as apple pie. He is what America is. He's not brand new. He's not teaching us anything that we didn't already know. He's exposing it, and people are attaching themselves to it because they want to be that. I mean, we've used propaganda in our country to make it seem like we can associate ourselves with humanity, but that's a damn lie, and you know it. Yeah. All of us know it. When the United Nations is suggesting that we stop killing our unarmed citizens, when you have countries that don't even have a percentage of the murders that we have from our law enforcement to citizens, to people that live here, we're talking about children. And we're not just talking about black people. We have a problem. 708 people have been killed by law enforcement as of today. I think there was one killed in Houston today.
Yeah, we're talking about killing now, but I think we have to broaden it. Obviously, the prison system.
The prison system, our community policing,
the way the
social
courts
services.
Work, the way the prosecuting attorneys work, the sentencing system, more and more police in schools.
Yes.
The country is moving towards this utter police state, particularly for black people. And the amount of number of people in prison, black people in prison, not just people given the death penalty, but people serving life without parole, 10 times the number of those people.
Look at how many people are in jail for nonviolent offenses.
And
they're looking at 15 to 25
years. It's horrible to really see it, although let me challenge one thing. That's one face of the country. There's another face of the country. There are a lot of white people and brown people and mixed people who are appalled and frightened, but in fact don't know the depth of it and are insufficiently active and not part of movements. And then there's a lot of people who are part of movements that are ineffective. It seems to me that there is the possibility of ultimately rallying against not just the police state, but the vigilante state.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about, though, the vigilante state
yes.
that's being set up.
Well, let's get on that, because in honor of Larnell Bruce, who was killed here in Oregon by a white supremacist last month, and, you know, they just re-indicted him after our protest on September 11th on hate crime charges. Most of the work that we've been doing in solidarity with the prison strike has been to look out for the safety of those that are incarcerated and also to hold law enforcement accountable for taking these complaints of racial injustice or bias or assaults or harassment or intimidation seriously, because they haven't been tracking them. They haven't used them to lead to safer communities. They haven't used them to expose the white supremacy and the retaliation that could be enforced using informants or non-people of color to, you know, assassinate or to cause problems and havoc in our communities. There's been no force of action against those type of gangs, but there's this entire country that is serving to force of action against black community members that live in poverty, and we identify them as gangs. We're leaving a whole wide circuit wide open. In the same community where Larnell Bruce was killed, they had white supremacist KKKs distributing information to community members, recruiting them. And we know that that's a known hate organization, but the police in our state were saying that that's something that should be ignored. When they rally at the Capitol, or when they burned Kate Brown's, a fake image of her at the Capitol the other day, they're not sending out riot cops to those type of people. And so they know that we're vulnerable. The black community is very vulnerable to vigilantism of all sorts, because what media has said is that if a black body is murdered, then it's obvious that another black person has pulled that trigger or put the lynch around that neck. And that's not the truth. We know that there's people that are accommodating themselves to violence because of the work that's being
done.
Yeah,
we're talking to Teresa Rayford, who is spent how many years now, Teresa?
6 years today.
6 years today, trying to expose the dirty underbelly, the way in which America is becoming more and more hostile and murderous towards black people and other people who they consider black and worthless, regardless of their color. Teresa, let's get back to, though, the vigilante problem and the rise of a white supremacy movement, a particularly virile anti-black movement. There was an incident in Northeast Portland recently where three young children were sprayed with bear spray by some white guy who then drove away. Tell us, they were the kids of a doctor at OHSU.
They don't want to be there. Pretty anonymous as a family, but it's not a doctor's family. She is a person that actually is employed there. And her children were, you know, in their community saying goodbye to their family member, their grandmother. And this is all in the news already. But he rode up on a bike, got off of his bike, was yelling racial slurs at the children, and then commenced to grabbing a bear spray can and spraying inside of the car where the children were buckled into their seatbelts. And when the family called to the police, and again, this is in the media as well, when the family called, the response was mostly like, what kind of kids are they and what do they do in the community? And there wasn't more of an urgence in getting a description of this person or collecting the tools that fell off of his bike so that they could, you know, look for possible fingerprints or do any type of investigation. It was more about what were the kids doing wrong? And that's a norm.
Why was this guy justified in bear spraying? They were they were beginning the way they ask about crime about killing investigations. Well, what distinguished this person?
These are children, and these are children. Who would ask that question?
It's bizarre.
It's not bizarre to me because I've been out here advocating for families for years. And like I told you, when Shaquita Lewis was talking about her daughter, Yashani Vaughn, being missing and saying, look, she's not coming home, they didn't even want to look for the little girl. They kept on saying, she's a runaway, she's a thug, this is ghetto. They didn't even want to respond until the family was saying, we're going to protest the police station. They don't take black crime when we're complaining about something, when we're calling the police. They keep saying they want to come in our community, they want to hang out in our schools, they want to be more engaged with us. When we call them and there's a problem, they do not take it as a problem. They take it as an opportunity to investigate the family. They take it as an opportunity to share information with other agencies, to dismantle that family, and to criminalize that family. And that is something that is so out of order. It is so out of order, and we don't have leaders fighting against that. But it, again, leaves us vulnerable.
Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Teresa Rayford. Teresa, first you're going to be talking to Charlie Hales. One of the good things about the march this Friday was you forced him to, in fact, discuss what the city is doing. If this is going to stop, and if we're going to change, we're going to do, quote, reform, real reform, there's going to have to be a really large movement of people of color and lots of whites.
Yeah.
And it seems to me we really have to build that movement. You talked earlier about, I sort of challenged you, that racism and violence are like apple pie,
mm-hmm.
part of America. But it seems to me there's another America, it seems to me, that is going to have to be organized and stand up, who I believe stand for very different principles and life ways, including environmental justice. There's huge there's really large numbers of people out there who recognize how rotten it really is.
They have to continue recognizing that in intersectionality, when we talk about recognizing things, we cannot acquiesce. We can never acquiesce. When we're dealing with epidemics in this country, if it was a physical disease, we would all be researching it. We would be looking for ways to beat it. We would be trying to knock it out. We need to do the same thing with racism and state-sanctioned discrimination from where we stand. When we're talking about the Vote Black platform and how it recognizes the movement for Black lives, what we're asking for is elected politicians and those running for office to connect with us so that we can discuss these issues. We have to have a voice. They have to come to our table.
Yeah, it also, though, talks about the absolute need for jobs programs for all of these young whites and blacks who are left without hope, who are not going to, in fact, be able to compete with those with money and support and schools that are well-funded. They're stuck at the bottom, and some of them go bad. One of the great things about that agenda, at least for me, is it talks also about housing. It talks about policy and how to dismantle. It talks about the drug wars, the prison pipeline, the need to develop affordable housing, to support cooperatives even, and Black economic and other development. Anyway, Teresa, thanks so much for talking to us today. I was Teresa Rayford.
Thank you, Bill.
This is a public service.
It's impossible to overstate the importance of ocean health for the health of the entire planet in every way imaginable, from socioeconomic to climate change. Today I'm sharing an article entitled The Sick Ocean by Robert Hunzigara. It's from the Counterpunch webpage. A major new scientific report explaining ocean warming was released on September 5th. it is grim. According to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, World Conservation Congress in Hawaii, the findings are based upon peer-reviewed research compiled by 80 scientists from 12 countries. It is the most comprehensive study ever undertaken on the subject of warming of the ocean. Significantly, the ocean has absorbed more than 90% of the enhanced heating from climate change since the 1970s. In other words, the ocean has been shielding us from the extensive effects of global warming, and the consequences for the ocean are absolutely massive. The seasons in the ocean are actually changing as a result. The scale of ocean warming is truly staggering, with numbers so large that it's difficult for most people to comprehend. Explaining ocean warming, ICUN Global Marine and Polar Program, September 2016 reports, a useful analysis undertaken by the Grantham Institute in 2015 concluded that if the amount of heat that has gone into the top 200 meters of the ocean between 1955 and 2010 had gone into the lower 10 kilometers of the atmosphere, then the Earth would have seen a warming of 36 degrees centigrade. In other words, humanity would be toast. Here's one of the many dangerous hooks mentioned in the report. Crucially, as evident in the past 2 years, the heat and CO2 accumulated in the ocean are not permanently locked away, but can be released back into the atmosphere when the ocean surface is warming, giving a positive rapid feedback to global warming, which would entail a decidedly harsh blow to life on the planet. The 500-page report is all-inclusive with several subsections dealing with individual oceanic issues. But a general overview of the chain of impacts is perhaps the most relevant to an understanding of the dire consequences of failure to act by halting CO2 fossil fuel emissions as soon as possible. The chain of impacts clearly demonstrates the linear interrelated behavior of ocean warming, ocean acidification, and sea level rise. Due to a domino effect of one problem cascading into others, key human sectors are now threatened, for example, fisheries, aquaculture, coastal risk management, general health, and coast tourism. In point of fact, scientific studies show rapid deterioration throughout the change of impact statement, such that an all-out alarm is necessitated. In short, the old public clarion bells need to start ringing hard and loud, because the impacts on key marine and coastal organisms, ecosystems, and ecosystem services are already detectable from high to low latitudes, transcending the traditional north-south divide. In other words, the entire world oceanic system is already showing signs of severe stress. Furthermore, the latency effect of human-caused global warming means the impact of today's carbon emissions shows up years and years down the line, such that, assuming carbon emissions drop to zero tomorrow, global warming continues cruising along for many years to come. All important, the ocean is a climate integrator that regulates the entire planetary biosphere by absorbing 26% of human-caused CO2 and 93% of additional planetary heat. Without the ocean, present climate change would thus be far more intense and challenging for human life. Meanwhile, the regulating function of the ocean comes with heavy costs. For example, ocean acidification and availability of carbonate ions are disrupted, which are building blocks for marine plants and animals to make skeletons and shells. The acidification impact is already a factor in the base of the food chain, as tiny pea-sized chloropods, which serve as food stock for everything from krill to salmon to whales, show ultra-thinning of their protective shells necessary for both reproduction and maturation, a problem especially found in the Southern Ocean. This early-stage risk to disruption of the food chain is caused by excessive carbon dioxide absorbed into the ocean emitted by fossil fuels. Astonishingly, sea level rise, the most notable oceanic impact, has already dramatically increased its rate of increase over the 1901 to 2010 period, as the rate of rise from 1993 to 2010 accelerated by an astounding 88%. The sea level rise is already felt in cities like Miami, where streets are being raised and additional pumping systems installed. Miami Beach is raising streets by 2 feet to combat rising seas. Assuming business as usual, human-caused climate change, sources of dietary protein, and income for tens of millions of people will likely be severely impacted by mass mortalities. Wherefore, the old clarion call bell needs to ring even louder, waking up citizens to the threat of impending serious food shortages. Fisheries and aquaculture, which are both key for survival for millions, are already at high risk. Meanwhile, and unfortunately, climate change continues to negatively affect land agriculture, which will likely exacerbate food shortages with the oceans simultaneously stressed. In all, ocean warming is synergistic with other human-induced stresses, such as overexploitation, like drift net fishing, and habitat destruction, for example, bleached coral and chemical pollution. The report has suggested solution to ocean stress, for example, mitigating CO2 emissions by getting off fossil fuels, is number one on the list, followed by protecting marine and coastal ecosystems by governmental regulation of protected areas, and repairing damaged ecosystems with, for example, coral farming and adapting economic diversification zones and activities. Importantly, the landmark study emphasizes the fact that unequivocal scientific evidence shows that impacts on key marine and coastal organisms, ecosystems, and services are already detectable, and that high to very high risks of impact are to be expected. That statement is as straightforward, pulling no punches, as scientific papers ever get. The evidence is crystal clear that climate change is disrupting the ocean, which is the only ocean we've got. There are no backups. That was an article entitled The Sick Ocean by Robert Hunzigara. Hunzigara is a professor of economic history at DePaul University and is a freelance writer and environmental journalist. The article can be found on the Counterpunch webpage.
Skies blue, poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me, mercy. All things and what they used to be lost, oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.
That was, of course, Marvin Gaye with his classic song, Mercy, Mercy Me, about the sick ocean. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The legal crackdown on sunbathers wearing the burkini in some French towns has generated a lot of heat. Many feminist critics have commented that this ban on the burkini, a bathing suit that covers the entire body, is sexist as well as anti-Muslim. Women's bodies are often the site of struggles in patriarchal societies, even in France, where the authorities claim to be protecting Muslim women while disrobing them. Several decades ago, one of the founding members of the Old Mole Variety Hour, Joan Bohorfish, produced a radio documentary, along with Dina Dickerson, on the multiple meanings of the headscarf in Islam. She and Dickerson interviewed Muslim women from the United States and the Middle East to understand the political and cultural practice associated with the veil, from the perspectives of Muslim women themselves. Joan Bohorfish died of ovarian cancer in 1997, but her radio commentary on the veil is as timely as ever.
Did you wear a veil back home? And did you live in a tent and ride a camel?
When they see a woman with the veil, the average American, oh la la, extremist, violent.
We think of them as veiled, as quiet, as demure.
Yeah, I think they really look at the surface, you know, they see all these images of women covered up in these black tents.
The Muslim headscarf, also known as the veil, the chador, and the hijab, it refers to the religious head covering worn by increasing numbers of Muslim women. The movement to wear the hijab marks the growing presence of Islam, both here in America and around the world. Yet most Americans know little about Islam or why Muslim women would choose to cover. What we do know often comes from Hollywood and media images. This story is about Muslim women and the global movement to take up the scarf. It is also about why we as Americans seem to have such a hard time with it.
I think that most Americans operate in the realm of stereotypes about Islam. You think, you know, people, unfortunately, and I don't think most news media have done much to rectify this image, that we think of, you know, bearded religious leaders saying absurd things, taking hostages, and terrorism.
Anita Weiss is director of the International Studies Program at the University of Oregon. She talks about media bias and the Oklahoma City bombing.
The stereotype really came to be so obviously out of line when, after the Oklahoma City bombings, it was immediately assumed that it must be some Middle East terrorist. And I know that the Muslim community in America was extremely upset about this, and very rightly so, especially now that, you know, it seems that it certainly wasn't that case at all.
Anita talks about how this stereotype of Islam extends to Muslim women.
Also, in terms of how Western, and we Oregonians often think about Muslim women, we think of them as veiled, as quiet, as demure, as withdrawn and not having a public role. That's also not true.
Well, I think many people have always thought Arab women were completely oppressed individuals who had no sense of identity or their own voice.
Naomi Shihab Nye is a Palestinian-American poet from San Antonio, Texas. Recently, she was in Portland, Oregon, and talked about the assumptions students often make about her poetry.
In fact, the other day up in Port Angeles, this group of university students had interpreted a poem that I wrote called Voices, which was about my American-German grandmother, as absolutely having to be about my Arab grandmother, because everyone knows that Arab women aren't allowed to speak up. Not at all. My Arab grandmother was the most talkative person in the West Bank. She would have told anybody anything without a moment's pause, and she did. When I was in Saudi Arabia, the women wanted to convey one message to me: you can tell your friends that we are oppressed in some ways, but we're also very lucky and we're not stupid.
In Hollywood films, veiled Muslim women seldom speak, nor do they play an active role. They are depicted as bundles of black, lacking a human face.
Did you wear a veil back home, and did you live in a tent and ride a camel?
Asil Nasser Dick is an Iraqi-American scholar who develops curriculum on the Middle East.
And those tend to be some of the things we often hear over and over again, and that are reinforced in a lot of the television programs and Hollywood films, and which are just so divorced from reality. I never wore a veil. My mom never wore a veil. My grandmother wore a cloak that covered her hair, but never covered her face.
Overseas in our country, it's not a bad thing, because everyone, you know, wear that and everyone believe in that. It's more acceptable there.
Wearing hijab is a familiar sight in Muslim countries, says Fareel Ghanayem, a Palestinian-American living in Portland. But here in the U.S., a covered woman is seen as an outsider.
But if I wear the same here in America and go to the supermarket, they will notice that she's different, she's Muslim.
Yeah, I think they really look at the surface. You know, they see all these images of, you know, women covered up in these black tents, you know. Chador is a tent. The word chador, like, literally translates into the word tent.
Alika Peruz, Iranian-American, believes that these perceptions keep people apart.
And of course, you know, that's really all they see, and they have little contact with these women, you know, who are covered. Even the women who are covered, you know, who live in Portland, you know, not many people approach them to really know who they are.
When she's out with her sister,
and myself, I noticed that her sister gets a lot more attention because she's not wearing the hijab.
Abir Sher is Lebanese-American and works in her family's delicatessen while she attends community college. She feels bad about the way salespeople often ignore her mother when they are out shopping in the mall.
Most salespeople tend to go straight to my aunt instead of my mom because she's wearing the hijab. They'll try to ignore her. They won't help her. They'll treat her in a really rude way. When they do this, I tend to leave the mall right away and just tell my mom, let's not get anything. And I let them hear it so that they know that they're hurting us.
America is known as the land of religious freedom. Yet Muslim women who wear the scarf are often denied this freedom.
As an organization, the North American Council for Muslim Women very often gets calls from women who need our help in finding out what to do when they're being told that they're going to be fired unless they take off the headscarves.
Sharif Al-Khatib is Arab American and president of the North American Council for Muslim Women in Washington, D.C. In her work, she defends the right of women to wear the hijab or Muslim headscarf.
There was a case of a woman trying to be hired in a hotel that was a franchise as a desk clerk, and they refused to hire her. The man thought she had all the qualifications but refused to hire her because he said that she doesn't need to wear the headscarf, and if she gets rid of that, then she's welcome to come and start her job. And the woman refused to do that. She said, I can't do that. It's part of my religion. I would say the majority of people in the U.S. at the moment do respect a person's right to wear their own religious garb, whether it be a yarmulke on a person's a Jewish man's head or a scarf on a Muslim woman's head, or a cross if a person is a Christian wants to wear that as a religious symbol.
Women are making it an issue now. It's become something that's important for personal identity for women in the United States.
Kathleen Moore, political scientist at the University of Connecticut, has been studying discrimination toward Muslim women who wear the hijab.
Even though not all Muslim women in the United States are taking these claims to court, obviously, they are formulating a legal rights claim, nonetheless, about their right to wear something like the headscarf in public places.
According to Kathleen, court cases go back to the 1960s when African-American women began demanding the right to wear the headscarf to work and taking their claims to court.
And so that African-American women's experience has brought sort of this knowledge of an experience with the legal system into the mainstream or into the fold of the Muslim communities at large in the United States.
While black Muslim women were claiming the right to wear modest dress during the 1960s, large numbers of non-Muslim women were asserting their right to wear the miniskirt. Kathleen explains how employers responded with a company dress code.
And when the miniskirt became shorter and shorter during the 1960s, they decided that the miniskirt was the kind of attire they wanted to prohibit in the workplace because that would attract attention. By the late 1980s, women came to work wearing the headscarf. Women who were Muslim began to wear that. And the employers used their old dress code. And so women who were choosing to conceal parts of their bodies for religious reasons were told that they couldn't come to work because they were in violation of a dress code.
For me, wearing hijab in this country is a very strong political statement of who I am.
She is in her early 30s, wears a black headscarf over a long tunic and jeans. Maria Al-Haddad is Greek-American. And for her and many other young Muslim women, wearing the hijab in America takes courage.
You may say, my God, what are you talking about? But no, it's a strong political statement. It is showing my freedom to do whatever I want and the strength of one's own convictions, and that I'm not going to be put down by what the status quo wants. It's a sign of fighting oppression.
I read a lot about what the hijab meant to different women, and one of the things that it meant was to have a sense of ownership of your own body.
Amy Bruner, Caucasian American, is an active member of the local Muslim community in Portland, Oregon. She sees the hijab as a challenge to the way women are often treated as sex objects in American society.
And I think that's very contradictory to the way Western women are brought up thinking about their body, that it's used to attract people, you're judged by it, there's a lot of problem with body image, and I would have to say that as an American woman, I suffered from some of that.
One of the things, though, I do want to say, I want to talk about the importance of the hijab as I think many Muslim women see it that choose to wear it.
Janie Nichols is a recent convert to Islam who works with Iraqi refugees. She explains why Muslim women want to wear the hijab.
They see it as a symbol of respect for women, not as a symbol of repression, and that they are preserving a part of themselves for their husband, for their immediate family members. And they actually see the West as exploiting women sexually in a very big way. And so that, in essence, it's saying, I'm not here to be exploited.
When people in Portland's Muslim community gather, the women are wearing hijab. For these women, the headscarf is a statement of their strength and pride.
I actually came to Islam because of the women, because I had grown up without a mother and without a mother's love, and the strength and the determination of Muslim women attracted me to them as a force.
Marian Dewan is a teacher in Portland's Muslim Community Center. Islam and the hijab are part of her African-American heritage.
As African-American women, we go back 20, 22, 25 years with head coverings. So it's not so much for us. It's not so much for us.
For Muslim women like Marian Dewan, wearing hijab is voluntary and an act of religious devotion. But for women who come from countries where veiling is enforced, it is not a matter of choice. It is the policy of the state.
They first implemented this "you have to cover yourself" thing. A lot of the women from offices, who, you know, a lot of business women, protested, and they had demonstrations against it, you know, because they didn't want to be covered.
Alika Peruz was a young girl when the Ayatollah Khomeini established the world's first Islamic Republic in 1979. She prefers not to use a real name. For her, the Khomeini regime took one version of the Islamic mandate to be modest and made it into law.
The Quran says that women have to dress modestly. It doesn't say anything about covering your hair, you know. But now there's all these laws. Like in Iran, you can only show your face and your hands from your wrist. You know, your hands. You know, but in different countries, you can't even show your face, or you can only show your eyes. Some women wear gloves. So everybody's just got their own rules, you know, based on the men who rule the country.
There was this woman that came to our school. She was a beautiful woman, and she said that starting in September, we're going to have to cover up.
Like Alika, Bahar Jabari is Iranian-American and was in her early teens when Khomeini came to power. Bahar tells how she first learned about the new state-imposed dress code.
She said, well, you know, this is the way you cover up. You cover your hair, you cover your body. If you have beautiful hands, you have to wear gloves. If you have pretty eyes, you have to wear sunglasses. All of that started happening. Allah, Allah.
At home, Alika talks with her mother, Afa, about the early days of the Khomeini regime. Afa remembers her nightmare of being caught in public without the veil.
Sometimes I had a nightmare that I went to the street without hijab and I caught by some pastors and revolutionary guards.
They would approach any woman in the street, any woman. Then they would say, you know, you go, we have to take you in because you're hair is shown or you have polish on your nail.
Mariam Baradar was finishing college in the U.S. at the time of the overthrow of the Shah and the Iranian Revolution. She describes what happened to women when they did not conform to the new dress code.
Many times they keep them 24 hours, 48 hours, without letting their family know where they are. It was a terrifying situation for women and for families.
There are Iranian women who rebel, and
Bahar Jabari tells of how Iranian women find ways of resisting.
They say that they make little crowns of hair in front of their scarves of different colors. You know, they dye them different colors and they bring them out like a, like Elvis's pompadour, just to say that I don't want to be under your control anymore.
In Iran and Saudi Arabia, veiling is enforced by a zealous religious police. Yet in most Muslim countries, as in the West, women can choose to cover.
Women who never covered their hair and whose mothers never covered and whose grandmothers never covered are now going back and covering their hair as a political statement.
Asil Nasser-Dick compares the modern movement of young Muslim women who are taking up the hijab with Algerian women who refused to take off their veils under French colonial rule.
And, you know, even in countries that were ruled, especially by France, did not allow the people to use Arabic. They closed down a lot of the religious schools. And in fact, in Algeria, would not allow women to cover their hair. And so the Algerian women did it in defiance as an example of their identity. You know, we will do this because this is what we are. And you can't mold us. We are not French.
Like the Algerian women under French rule, many Palestinian women under Israeli occupation have returned to modest Islamic clothing as a way to preserve their identity.
After the occupation, you know, the Western culture came to the West Bank and Gaza.
Fareel Ghanayem.
And people felt that they are losing their own culture. They don't want their new generation to forget who they are.
Hanan Ashrawi, Palestinian scholar and spokesperson in the Arab-Israeli peace talks, came to Oregon to speak at Willamette University. Backstage, we asked her view on the return to the veil among Palestinian women.
I don't know if there is a return to the veil or to the hijab. There was at a certain point when Hamas was very active as an Islamic political movement, there was an increase, let's say, in the use of the hijab. Now, to us, it's not a question of going forward or going back. It's a question of choice. If people feel that wearing the hijab is an expression of their religion and their religious commitment and faith, that's fine. What we were trying to fight against is coercion, that women should not be made to wear a dress code if they don't want to.
Some of it has to do with really, you know, how hard life is for women in these countries.
Elika Peruz.
And they have to, you know, they kind of have to produce this wall around them. I mean, the veil is like a wall, you know, like a personal wall around you. And it allows you to come outside of the, like, private realm of your house or something.
We don't have the same problems. The problems are different, and each woman chooses the card which give her empowerment.
Fatima Mernissi, Moroccan sociologist and Muslim feminist, spoke to us during a conference on Muslim women in Washington, D.C.
So For this woman, it's to wear the veil. For me, it's to cut my hair short and put a lot of henna on it and have it very shiny and attractive.
While Fatima Mernissi believes that wearing hijab can be a card for women's empowerment, she sees force veiling as symbolizing a lack of democracy.
The issue is not the veil. The issue is access to public space. And it doesn't concern only women. In countries where the veil is forced on women, like in Iran, Saudi Arabia, men also are not political actors in the public space. So the key questions we are asking is not about saying, oh, keep the women in the house. But what house? Most of the men do not have houses. So the issue is how the resources are going to be used. For what purpose? That's what the veil is about. It's masking, in fact, the real key issues, which are clay. It's the dialogue about how we want this little planet to be.
How do we want this little planet to be, and what are the barriers to the dialogue between Muslim and non-Muslim? Nimat Barazangi, Syrian-American, is a visiting scholar at Cornell University and a covered woman. She worries that veiling itself may be a barrier to that dialogue.
The idea of polarizing a Muslim woman only on the issue of veil is really a misrepresentation of the Muslim woman, whoever she may be, whether she veils or doesn't veil. The way I put it is just ask other women, why do they go to church or synagogue? It's equally the same question. Why don't you ask them that, but you ask Muslim woman, why does she veil, and what does the veil mean?
Maybe we only ask these women why they veil because we as Americans have accepted the media images of Muslim women, images which keep us from seeing who they really are. We do not seem to appreciate that veiling is a cultural and religious practice.
Whether a woman chooses to cover her hair is a cultural value.
Asil Nasser Dick.
It has nothing to do with her ability to have a career, to live a meaningful life.
We are individuals as well as Muslims.
Janie Nichols.
And there are differences within Islam, there are differences within cultures, and we are part of those differences. We count, we matter as human beings. Try to get past the headscarves, as it were, to get to know us as people.
You've been listening to Scarves of Many Colors, Muslim Women and the Veil, co-produced by Joan Bohorfish and Diana Dickerson, with sound design by Joe Waters and funding from the Oregon Council for the Humanities.
That was Joan Bohorfish with her radio documentary, Scars of Many Colors. As I mentioned before, Joan was a founding member of the Old Mole back in 1989 and passed away from ovarian cancer in 1997. For more information on the audio documentary or to order the accompanying curriculum guide, contact Old Mole Jan Hawken here at KBOO. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. This is KBOO Portland.